Fact Chat.
Malcolm Turnbull announced that the laws of math do not apply here.
One of my favourite brands of comedy, Ariel, is brown people and black people making fun of white people.
Senators have been dropping like flies recently.
Shouting out the fact that in the Knowles Carter family, women just have one name.
Back Chat on FBI Radio.
You're listening to Back Chat on FBI Radio 94.5, streaming on FBIRadio.com. The freshest wrap of news and politics. It's Saturday the 28th of October, nearly Halloween. I'm Osman Faruqi.
I'm Sam Johnshire.
Thanks, Sam. Legendary EP stepping in for Ariel, who's fled to China.
Fled to China.
To have fun. We're looking forward to hearing from her. And we are just a few days away from Halloween, and there's been some spooky stuff happening in Canberra that it would have been hard to miss. But yesterday, the High Court delivered its landmark judgment on a group called the Citizenship Seven, which I think is like the lamest name to anyone has ever come up with to describe any group of people. We had the Budgie Nine, we had the Magnificent Seven, which is a movie, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a movie.
The Hateful Eight, that was also a movie. Eight. And the Citizenship Seven.
Oh, and then there's that group, there's that youth fiction novel.
Oh, like the Famous Five?
Famous
Five.
The youth
fiction novel.
I didn't grow up here. I don't know what you people did.
I mean, Enid Blyton's not Australian. But anyway, the Citizenship Seven were the seven federal MPs who faced allegations that they were ineligible to serve in federal parliament because they had dual citizenship. And it all kicked off when Scott Ludlam and Larissa Waters from the Greens resigned because they were respectively New Zealand and Canadian citizens without being aware of it. And the High Court ruled on seven of them. It found that five of them were ineligible, including Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce, who has now been, he's kicked out of Parliament. He's not the Deputy PM anymore. He's not a minister. He's not even a politician. And he now has to run for his seat in a by-election on December the 2nd.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy stuff. I mean, you know, they're zombies. They won't die.
Barnaby, yeah, I think a lot of people I spoke to yesterday who might not be Barnaby's biggest fans were excited about him being booted out, but then I had to explain to him that he's probably going to come back.
Because Tony Windsor probably isn't going to run.
No, so Tony Windsor, who's the independent, right, who held that seat for like a decade, he announced that he wasn't going to run yesterday afternoon. There could be like some other, you know, high-profile independents that throw the hat into the ring. It's all kind of causing a bit of stress for the government because they had a one-seat majority and now they don't. They don't have a working majority.
I think when you have a one-seat majority and you lose one person, you go down to a zero-seat majority.
That's right.
Crazy.
Totally. And there's, you know, rumours that Labour might try and make the most of that by moving some sneaky no-confidence motions and trying to bring down the government. Probably won't work because there will be some independents that support the government in that event. I think Cathy McGowan and Bob Catter are likely to back them up. But nonetheless, just when you think Australian politics might have calmed down for a second, you get this kind of crazy week.
Well, here we are on the eve of Halloween and some spooky things.
Yeah, and Sam, you've got some other stuff you want us to talk about that is also pretty bloody spooky.
Pretty bloody spooky. What do you do, Oz, every day?
I go to work every day.
Yeah, you know what? I also go to work.
Day.
But
yeah,
you know what? A lot of young people like us don't go to work every day.
Right, right.
Anglo Hair has just put out a report that shows that entry job levels in May, there were 125,000 of them 125,000 people looking for jobs.
Yeah.
And only about 25,000 entry level jobs available.
Damn.
So for every, in New South Wales, for every one entry level job, you know, the kind that you and I would be going for. Mm.
Speak for yourself, buddy.
Look,
I'm an extremely successful, experienced professional.
Extremely. Well, you should put that in a business card, Oz. I haven't seen that recently. Yeah. What's your LinkedIn look like?
I've never had LinkedIn.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So for every entry-level job going, there are five people applying for it, which that's pretty cooked.
And in Tasmania, apparently, it's 11 people.
Which is super cooked.
And
I mean,
it kind of goes a long way to explaining, I think, how a lot of young people feel in the current economy and struggling to get work or struggling to find full-time work that's relevant to what they've studied or what they've got skills in. And the government's response to that has been pretty bad, to put it bluntly. It's just like, well, try a little bit harder, you know, go on a dodgy kind of welfare scheme where you do an internship for $4 an hour.
And where can you do those internships?
Well, yeah, at cafes, right? That's basically all that you can really do. And the problem that I always find with this is that the numbers keep bearing out that there is a youth employment problem, and the government just doesn't want to accept it.
Or do anything to help people skill up or maybe move into, you know, a new kind of job that's emerging.
That's right. And there was another report that came out this week from the Productivity Commission looking at the impact on university education in particular and what impact that was having on the employment market. And it found that only 70% of recent graduates are in full-time work. And that's the lowest employment level for graduates in Australia since records began in the 1980s.
Yeah, I feel like when you do a uni degree, you do it because you really want that job on the other end.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, I got a huge hex debt, and the idea was that I would have a job that would
pay me. Me too. Pay me, I also have a giant hex debt.
Yeah, and now I think it's actually getting worse and worse for every single cohort. So we're relatively lucky, and the people studying now are going to have it even worse than us. They're just not jobs at the end of the pipeline. And out of that 70% who do have full-time work, a full third of them are working in jobs or professions that they didn't even need their degree for. So they've gone to university, they've studied, they've probably had a good time, and they've racked up this debt, and now they can't get a job that actually makes use of it. And that seems to be a pretty cooked scenario.
Also seems pretty cooked for society, right? I mean, we want people who are highly trained in things. You know, that's the only way we're ever going to...
For sure. Like, we need nurses and teachers and I mean, we need more doctors, I guess. Do we need more doctors?
Rurally.
Rural doctors. Yeah, we need
regionally.
More. Regionally. Maybe we could do with some less lawyers and
fewer lawyers. I agree
students.
With that.
No, we shouldn't judge people on what they study, but also we should because...
Our guest is a lawyer.
Okay. No, we absolutely shouldn't. We shouldn't be making fun of them. Because lawyers can do a lot of very, very cool and important stuff, as you're going to find out a little bit later on in the show when we start talking about a secret New South Wales police program that targets people as young as 10. Based on a series of kind of algorithms and factors they don't make public, and they're trying to stop future crime like Minority Report.
That is super cooked. But also what is super cooked is I called up some people this week.
Yeah, yeah.
I spoke to some young people like ourselves about how their job hunt went, and it was pretty grim.
Yeah, let's find out. This is Elsa.
So when I graduated, I was expecting it to be pretty tough because I'd heard other people had tough experiences as well. But I really wasn't prepared for how little jobs were available to me as a graduate and how many companies genuinely don't want to hire graduates. A lot of full-time jobs were expecting a lot of experience, even entry-level graduate work, were expecting a lot of experience that I was never offered during my degree. Like, even though I had part-time work in just normal kind of minimum wage jobs, I applied for about 40 all-up, which I actually think is a pretty small number compared to some other people. But I was only offered one job, and that's the job I took at the end of those 6 months.
That was Elsa. She has a science degree. She studied chemistry at university, and she was telling us a little bit about her struggles, I guess, the high number of graduates looking for jobs versus the number of jobs available. And we also heard, Sam, you spoke to Cade earlier.
Yeah, Cade studied econometrics, which is data science. Sounds pretty employable to me.
Didn't even know what econometrics was, but it's data science, that's what it is.
It's
let's see how things went for Cade after uni.
I officially started looking for a grad job halfway through my third year, and I probably didn't get a job until 6 months after I graduated. I got 3 or 4 interviews, and like one of those interviews was the job that I got, but that was a really low hit rate for like super personalised application. That included things like full-on graduate applications where, you know, you had to say, why do you think that you are great for this role, or why do you think the company should hire you, and really extensive, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 word applications.
It's Kay talking about his troubles finding a job after studying econometrics, which is data science, for everyone who didn't know, like me. We're keen to hear your thoughts. Are you struggling to find work? Have you had a lot of luck finding work? Is your university degree as valuable as you expected? You can text us in on 0409 945 945. Let us know your experience is finding work as a young person, and you know we'll talk about it a little bit later on in the show. Right now, we're going to play you a tune from a Sydney band called Crane Games. It's a couple of brothers, Mike and Will, and their friend Mia. They're out of Sydney. This is their song, End of the Decade. That was Crane Games with End of the Decade, new band out of Sydney. You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio 94.5 and streaming on FBIRadio.com. Oh, and the Crane Games, they just don't want to go away. That's their other song, So Long. It's great. You should listen to it as well. You can check them out on Bandcamp. Well, this week, the Youth Justice Coalition, a network of lawyers, social workers, and academics, released a report that shone a light on a secretive program the New South Wales Police have been running. It's targeting kids across the state as young as 10. It's called the STMP, the Suspect Target Management Plan, or STOMP, which is what a great acronym for a police program. Police say that it's an important crime prevention strategy, and it's carried out with respect and tolerance for those involved, but the report suggests that might not always be the case. And we're joined today in the studio by Dr. Vicky Sentes, a senior lecturer at UNSW and one of the report's authors. Thanks so much for joining us, Vicky.
Thanks for having me.
How did you first come across the STMP program?
Well, it's an interesting one because the program was first introduced 17 years ago, so it's been around for a really long time. But it's really surprising that absolutely, you know, most people haven't heard of it before. Mm. So I first came across it when I was working with Redfern Legal Centre, which is a well-known community legal centre, and that was about 3 years ago. So I run a police powers clinic because Redfern Legal Centre run a statewide practice where they support people with complaints against the police. So ranging from things like, you know, people who've been assaulted by the police or unfairly or unlawfully stopped and searched. So they're one of the go-to legal centres that help people. And so I was there supervising students at the clinic, and we had clients who would say, oh, the police have been constantly stopping and searching me, coming to my house late at night, but I'm not on bail conditions. My criminal matter's been finalised, but the police are still coming around and asking me questions. And that's not strange. They don't have the power. They don't have the power to do that. And the young people would say, well, they say it's because I'm on a stomp and they can do this. We're like, what is this stomp? And so from that time, we started to piece together from the ground up what was going on. We worked with other community legal centres, so the Public Interest Advocacy Centre, you know, had quite a few clients. And once we started to talk, you know, to other organisations like the Aboriginal Legal Service, Legal Aid, and other CLCs, it was clear there was a pattern going on here. And to be clear, the program isn't targeted just to young people, so it targets adults as well. But because the member centres, you know, are all members of the Youth Justice Coalition, and there are particular issues for young people. I mean, young people are over police generally because they use public space in different ways. There's this particular attention to the crimes that young people police. So this idea that it's a large-ish category in terms of the percentage of crime. So the police force does have a particular focus on preventing and stopping youth crime in particular.
So from the police's perspective, what is the point of the STOMP program? What are they trying to achieve?
There's a couple of different ways of understanding the STOMP program. So from the police perspective, the idea is that they have targets to reduce crime. They want to reduce offending. And from their perspective, the STOMP is a predictive policing tool. So this idea that you have this data that you analyse that says there's a small number of people who keep committing the same crime. So from their perspective, if you target so-called recidivists, so people who've committed offences before, it's much more cost-effective and efficient if you look at those people and if you monitor them to see if they're going to commit crimes in the future, or if you keep an eye on them and it will stop them. People will feel so scared or surveilled or monitored that they'll think twice about committing a crime in the future. So for the police, it's seen as a way to use their resources efficiently. And what the police will also say is that it reduces crime, but they haven't produced, to our knowledge, an evaluation that it's actually the case. So crime has been going down in most Western industrial cities, you know, over the last 10, 15 years. And there are so many variables involved. Mm. Like, you can't simply assert that one thing is reducing crime. But even if that is the case, statistically, we're saying it's not appropriate. It's not fair. It has to be within the law. And there's certain things that, you know, the police have to be governed by law. They have to conduct their interactions with people according to the law. And what we're finding is instances where that's not the case.
You mentioned the lack of kind of transparency around how this program operates. I understand from reading the report that extended to getting data about, you know, just basic things underpinning, you know, what sort of processes and factors the police use and the outcomes of that. How did you go about collecting the data for this report? And were there any pieces of information that particularly surprised you?
Well, firstly, we wanted to get access to the policy because the STOMP is many things. It's a policy, it's a tool, it's a policing practice. And we were very surprised that we couldn't get access to the policy through Freedom of Information.
Right.
And that was something that the Public Interest Advocacy Centre challenged through the Administrative Tribunal, NCAT. And unfortunately, NCAT found against the decision and said, well, it's an intelligence tool. It's a document that comes from a unit in the police called the State Crime Command. Therefore, there's a presumption against disclosure. They said that it wasn't in the public interest, given that it would reveal something operational about the police. Now, we say that's a huge problem. So we couldn't get access to the policy. And that also means that if you are on a stomp, the police create a personalised plan in relation to you, which has the risk categories and the reasons, presumably, the reasons why you're placed on the stomp. So we think that everyone should be able to have access, if they're on the stomp, to the reasons why and to know why they're actually on the stomp and to be able to challenge it in some way and to find out how to get off it. What we did was we made a request to the New South Wales Police Information Unit for data across all of New South Wales. Now, they said it was very difficult, not possible, to provide us with all of that data. So we made a very specific request for information about 10 local area commands. So there's, you know, over 70 local area commands in New South Wales. So we thought, and it was end up being quite prohibitively expensive. So, you know, data and information in this state is unfortunately not free if you're trying to get large amounts of data. We actually have no idea how many people overall are on the STMP, but we could predict it might be in the low thousands.
Right.
I mean, we were able to get information for those 10 local area commands that on the face of it looks like a small number of people. So it's about 213 people in 2015 in one particular point in time. What was surprising about that data was, well, in a sense it wasn't surprising, was there was a really incredible disproportionate number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Nearly half, right, of the people in the program?
So for about 44%. So, yeah, 44%. And that was, and one thing that's important to note is that the local area commands that we chose, we did choose places where there were relatively higher populations than the national average of Aboriginal peoples.
But even so, I think the report found that in the Redfern local area command, 60% of the people on the stop were of Indigenous background. And that's still wildly disproportionate compared to the population, right?
That's right. So in places like the Orana LAC, which is sort of in western parts of New South Wales, that, you know, might be like a 13% population and 44% is...
Right.
Yeah.
So 48.8% of STMP targets were young people under 25, and nearly 24% of people on the stomp were under 18. What kind of concerns do you have for people of those ages being on this kind of program?
Well, police have a special responsibility and a duty of care to young people, and that's really clearly stated in their policy approaches. So if you look at the police youth strategy, you know, it sort of says that policing is effectively a last resort. So we're concerned that young people on the STMP is kind of breaching all sorts of duties that the police have to, you know, divert young people from the criminal justice system. So our research showed that putting young people on an STMP actually, of course, obviously increases police contact. It increases their chances of being detected for really minor offences. So a couple of the young people, the case studies that we present, might have had a really small amount of cannabis on them. And regardless of whether they've committed offences in the past, so under the Young Offenders Act, if you've committed a minor offence and it's the first time, you can, you know, get a warning or a caution. And I think what the police are inadvertently doing, they've got this category of young people who are saying, these are bad kids. These are not good kids who've just made a mistake. And we're saying, regardless
as
of...
As
young as 10. So we're saying that whether young people and children have committed offences in the past, you have to look at what kind of offences. So
for sure,
the police, I think, will likely say, you know, young people who are committing violence offences need to be on the STMP. So we're not making a distinction. We're saying all young people have the right to freedom and safety from police intervention. And if we're looking at addressing the causes of crime, if there are young people who are persistent offenders, I mean, the best practice is it's about therapeutic, holistic interventions to get to the cause of what's happening. It might be family dysfunction. It might be, you know, because they come from really poor, disadvantaged families. So we're saying address the causes. And there's a lot of research that says that is effective and that over policing, you know, high intervention policing. There's no evidence to suggest that actually addresses the causes of young people's offending.
For sure. We're talking to Dr. Vicky Sentis from the University of New South Wales, and she's one of the co-authors of a Youth Justice Coalition report looking into the STMP program and particularly how it impacted young people. We are running out of time, Vicky, but I wanted to get your perspective on what you think should be done. Like, are there recommendations you're putting forward to change the program?
Absolutely. So we've got 8 recommendations we're making to both New South Wales Police directly and to the Law Enforcement Conduct Commission, which is the oversight body in New South Wales. We're saying the first thing that New South Wales Police, they can do very easily and quickly is don't put children under 18 on the STMP. We also think there's a case that, you know, adults as well as young people shouldn't be on the STMP. So we're saying make the policy publicly available, tell us what the risk categories are, and give the data to BOCSAR, the Bureau of Crime Statistics, get them to do an analysis around and make that public. And we want the Law Enforcement Conduct Commission to do a system-wide review to look at the police data to tell the public what's going on and how it's used.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much, Vicky, for joining us on Backchat this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Vicky is going to stick around for our favourite segment, Backchat Roulette. Yeah, it's a segment where we all talk very quickly about things that we thought were important that all of you missed out on. Vicky, you're our guest. Do you want to kick it off?
I haven't read a book for ages, and I just read this fabulous book. It might be old news. I'm not really up to date with things.
Is it Harry Potter?
Harry Potter, excellent book. So it's kind of related to what we were talking about. So it's this book by, oh, my God, I've forgotten her name.
Well, tell us the name of the book. Maybe we can help.
So it's like The Hate You Give, Angela. Her name's gone.
Sam's furiously Googling this to help.
The Hate You Give. So it's a young adult fiction. And
Angie Thomas.
Okay, sorry, Angie, if you're listening. I believe I forgot your name.
She's a long-time listener, Angie. Come on.
So it's taken, you know, the world by storm and perhaps me, you know, a bit too late. And I just finished reading it and it's fabulous. And it's basically about this young teenager who's a black teenager in the States who's seen her best friend, kind of unarmed friend, shot by police. So it takes us an inspiration from the Black Lives Matter movement.
Heard about this book, yeah. Mm. Awesome. Thank you. I will check it out. I think our listeners should as well. You're like the third person to recommend it to me recently. Sam, what have you got for us?
This is a book that came out like about a year ago, and I read it kind of around then, but I think it's like super relevant, especially when we're talking about algorithms that might be pointing to some results that we may not want, like the stomp. It's called Weapons of Math Destruction. Good pun. How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy by Kathy O'Neill. She's a data scientist, and she basically goes through a whole bunch of different examples of where algorithms and big data has been used in ways that just are completely inappropriate for the data at hand and are applied to situations that are just really inappropriate. And basically, she just kind of creates a bit of friction around the idea that numbers can solve everything. Math scientist, loves numbers, but just thinks that a lot of data is used against people opposed to actually in line with how we should be thinking about numbers.
Cool. Awesome. Another great book recommendation. My story is not a book, actually. It was a political story that came up this week, and I think it got buried by the High Court announcement. It had to do with the Uluru statement earlier in the year, where a large group of Indigenous elders, experts, advocates, lobbyists sat down and talked about the way forward for reconciliation and discussed things like recognition. One of the outcomes of that was a referendum that they wanted to be put to the Australian public to look at the possibility of a lawmaking body on behalf of Indigenous people. The government this week rejected the idea of putting anything like that to a referendum, and it's caused a fair bit of consternation amongst the people who have been advocating for. I think Megan Davis is one of your colleagues, Vicky, at the University of New South Wales, has come out swinging against the government for the way that they've treated this whole process. And hopefully the issue doesn't go away. I think the government is certainly hoping that it just gets buried and that's the end of it. But it's, you know, they've talked the talk. They every year they talk about closing the gap. They talk about reconciliation. And when the plan has been put forward by these Indigenous advocates and the government just rejects it, I think it's a pretty disappointing set of outcomes. And particularly when we've got this joke of a plebiscite on marriage equality that no one wanted and said there's this other option for a referendum that people do actually want, that's not going to happen. It got me a bit mad.
And the government said this week that they could only deal with one big issue at once.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Jesus Christ.
It's funny. The government.
There's a lot of things going on.
There's a lot of portfolios there.
Look, that's all we've got time for on Backchat this morning. Thanks again, Vicky, for joining us. Sam, thanks for filling in for Ariel and stepping in front of the mic. And a special thanks to our producers, Amelia Zhao and Max Chalmers. Agenda is up next, and FBI, we're going to leave you with this tune from One Day. It's Love Me Less. Have a great weekend, everyone.